You're listening to Conversations with John Anderson, featuring Peter Hitchens.
So, Peter, thank you very much for giving us some time. Can I begin by saying that in my country, and I think it's probably pretty much the same right across the West now, the research and the data shows what the sort of seat of the pants assessment will tell you. People are very distrustful of the system, politics, the institutions of our society, the church, and they're badly fractured as well. They're fragmenting into groups that seem very hostile to each other. How has it come to this?
Well, it's come to this because ultimately things have an effect long after they've happened. When I was a small child, I lived near the great seaports of Portsmouth and Southampton and would go down to the beach and watch the great ocean liners, which still then went backwards and forwards across the Atlantic. And there was a game you could play. You could watch, say, the Queen Elizabeth, enormous ship, pass by about 2 miles out. And you would then wait for the bow wave to come. Sometimes you'd wait so long you'd forgotten it was coming, and then you'd turn your back on it, and it would whack you in the back so hard it would knock you over. There was a huge distance in time between the event and its effect. And I think we see now the effect of the collapse of particularly of European Christianity, which I think began in and then followed on from the First World War, where the churches made the grave mistake of supporting a war which turned out quite patently not to be a Christian act or to be the great war for civilization that had been portrayed as being, and so associated themselves with wickedness on such a scale that they could never really recover their moral authority, and it began to drain away from them from that point. But of course people continue to act. You don't suddenly get an audible click and people suddenly stop behaving in a Christian fashion because the churches are collapsing. The cultural Christianity, the general understanding of Christian rules, the general knowledge of the scriptures, the Sermon on the Mount, persisted in the population and still persists in people of a certain age, but has pretty much vanished. I was reading the other day that thanks to various films and children's fiction, many English children now know the Greek myths far better than they know the Gospels. They simply are not taught the Gospels, for instance. They're not. They don't know the parables, which have been a huge influence, for instance, on my life. I know them. You can't expect this kind of cultural earthquake to happen and for it not to have an effect. The amazing thing is that it's taken so long. But the wave has finally struck the beach and people are seeing it. The two great consequences, the two great material consequences of Christianity for the societies in which it's been prevalent are trust, on which almost all serious activities must be based, and the rule of law over power. How can anyone accept that law should be more authoritative than temporal power unless they believe that it has some sort of divine origin? And once that goes, it goes. So these things are departing from among us. While we continue to live in highly advanced, physically and technically advanced as well, civilizations, where those advances are ultimately based on trust and the rule of law. In the end, as they depart, those societies will cease to operate as they have done. And I think it is an ineluctable process, which we're lucky only to be seeing the beginning of.
So to draw something out of that, when trust breaks down in a democracy, people flee for security.
Well, democracy is another question. And I'm not really a Democrat. I don't think that universal suffrage democracy has been a success. I believe that liberty under the law is the great possession of the Anglosphere countries, and that universal suffrage democracy has tended to be inimical to, indeed it is inimical to freedom as well, as we've recently seen in Turkey, where universal suffrage democracy has been used to destroy the rule of law, to destroy freedom of speech, thought and assembly, freedom of the press, and to create a very dangerous autocracy. There's another example of that, but under Godwin's law, one must never mention the Nazis. But it's not the only example where democracy has destroyed freedom. But I don't rely particularly on democracy as a defence of the things that I love. It's a thing you just have to put up with.
I think the point I was seeking to draw out, though, is that given that you have a democracy, if people become, if you like, afraid, they flee for security. If they think people and institutions are not going to do what they ought to do voluntarily, they flee for the rule book, and that starts to erode freedom? Perhaps the irony so. But
what they also do is they flee towards populists, and the Trump phenomenon is an example of this. And it's also said there are many, many reasons for the Trump phenomenon. In some ways, he behaves much as the left do, which is why they don't like him. In terms of semi-literate intolerance of opponents, the politics of incels and all the rest of it. But the other thing is, of course, that social liberals in Western societies for many, many years imagined their opponents were all like Donald Trump, and so they ignored them and paid no attention to them. Eventually, they've got a real Donald Trump, and now they're angry. But if they listened to people like me 20 years ago, then they would never have got people like Donald Trump. But they do. But populism is a grave danger. I mean, we have the structures of universal suffrage democracy, and out of it, all kinds of monsters can be born. And I fear the consequences of it, especially if we get, as I think, I know your own country has different economic problems from mine, but if we get the economic crisis, which seems to me cannot be indefinitely postponed, given the level of particularly of personal debt that we have in this country, then the structures go, then I think the tendency towards some kind of pretty savage populism will be strong.
It's hard to avoid that conclusion, I think, actually. And there will be another recession. There always is. And most Western countries have used the remaining shots in their lockers. They won't be able to pump prices again.
We know that the same things are being done as were being done before the 2008 crash, and with knobs on. And I remember some years ago a quite a clever but failed film called Contagion. I mean, I saw it on an aeroplane because it probably in the cinema was about 2 minutes before it failed, which was about a sort of swine flu outbreak, bird flu outbreak, suddenly spreading throughout the civilized countries. And I think the reason it failed was because it was such a believable portrayal of what happens to an advanced country when there is a general breakdown of authority and where things cease to exist. And if you get a situation, which I very much fear, where money dies, then things of that kind might happen. I'm genuinely worried about the near future. I don't think it's good, and particularly for my own country, where we have especially strong problems. One, a ridiculous overestimate of our own importance and wealth and our own ability to trade. And secondly, a tremendous inbuilt economic crisis based upon unsustainable debt.
So given the nature of these intractable problems, and given that the evidence is quite overwhelming that they are real, they're not imaginary, they're not going to go away,
no.
Why is it then that we are unable to pull together enough for long enough to have a reasoned debate about any of this?
At some point, I mean, I'm an ex-Bolshevik, and this does two things for me. One, it means that I have a lot to be guilty about. Secondly, it gives me insights into the politics and nature of the modern left, which most people don't have. One of the things that I did when I was still a revolutionary socialist was try and prevent people from exercising freedom of speech and thought. It came naturally to me. It came naturally to me because I believed that what I thought and desired was so good that anybody who disagreed with me must, by their nature, be evil and be deserving of being silenced. And this is the problem. The general left-wing belief, which is held by the elites of most Western countries now, is also a belief in their own virtue. And if you believe very strongly in your own virtue, and your virtue is based, it's almost a caricature of justification by faith alone. You are a good person because you hold certain opinions. Therefore, if you hold other opinions, you're a bad person. And I think that makes dialogue pretty much impossible. If you think your opponent is bad, not just wrong, but bad, why should you listen to a word he says? Well, they don't.
Well, why is it then that we can't learn the lessons of history? It's not as if it's so very... You lived in Soviet Russia for a long time. You saw the outcomes of that sort of elitist view.
The left have learned the lessons of history to this extent. They understand that the Bolshevik attempt failed, that the Soviet experiment was a disaster. That hasn't cured them of wanting to create paradise on Earth. They've just thought, how should we do it another way? Which is how we come to Antonio Gramsci, one of the first and most intelligent communists to understand that the Soviet experiment had failed as long ago as the 1920s. He realized that the civilized working classes of Western Europe were never going to swallow this sort of thing, that there had to be a huge cultural revolution before they ever would. And his ideas took root, particularly in the big Southern European communist parties, his own in Italy, in the final years of the Soviet Empire, and began to spread out beyond the communist parties themselves into the left in general, the ideas of cultural, moral and social revolution, not by violent overthrow, not through dictatorship of the proletariat, not even through seizure or sequestration of industries and banks, but through the capture by the long march to the institutions of the television studio and the university and the newspaper office and the publishing house and the school, so that after 30 or 40 years of that, you would control pretty much the public mind and you would be able to get pretty much what you wanted. And it's clever. And you have to concede to these people some admiration for their endless determination, their deep belief in what they want, and their subtle and in many cases very clever organization to achieve it. It's been a very, very well exercised revolution, and they have learned from history. The one thing they haven't learned, which I wish they would learn, is that they're wrong. But they have learned how to be wrong better. And that is why we have to fear them so much.
So two questions immediately arise for me. Given that the great bulk of people are surprisingly sensible when it comes to not being misled by intelligentsia.
I would completely disagree with that. I think the great bulk of people are incredibly easily misled. I find it over and over again. People I like, people with who might write to me one week and say, "I really liked what you wrote." The next week will be sprouting some drivel about the Russian menace, or whatever fashionable nonsense happens to have been fed to them by the media they trust. It's extraordinary how gullible people are.
I find that a very challenging thought as somebody from a country where we pride ourselves on our pragmatism and our ability to see through bulldust. We think we do. Now, you've been
to Australia. Well, of course, one of the great things about thinking that you see through it is that people who think that and who pride themselves on it are often the most fantastically gullible people of all.
Well, it's an interesting...
It takes some nerve not to run with the crowd. I mean, I'm not given particularly to self-praise. I know my faults better than most people. And thanks to an awful lot of YouTube, I also know what I look like. Vanity is difficult in my position. But one thing I will say is that I have, maybe it's an instinct I've had since childhood, probably a gift not given to me, not a thing that I can claim any credit for, but I will not run with crowds. But most people will, and they do, and they're happier that way.
Well, there's a point Jordan Peterson makes to his classes in Canada. You know, he points out to people that statistically speaking, they might say that they would not have joined the Hitler Youth, but statistically speaking, they would have.
Yeah.
We would have. I would have, probably. But it does still concern me, particularly in my own country.
I mean, you look at the were people who didn't. I mean,
very few.
Joachim Fest, I think, read this book called Not Me, about it, mainly about his father saying, "I'm not having this." But it was extremely hard not to do. And it was, and most people did it. And just as most people wouldn't have been in the French Resistance if they'd been in France in 1942, they just wouldn't have done it.
Anyway, that was part one, as a sort of plea on behalf of people in the street. They need to be more conscious of what's happening. But the second part that I wanted to drill into there is, you're very, very bright people, at least we think we have, we taxpayers in universities. Why are there not more academics? You know, if wisdom is the ability to understand consequences and courage is the ability to point them out, why are there not more academics pushing back against some of these ideas which have proven not just disastrous in practice, but as you point out, in theory as well? They don't work in theory. Communism doesn't work in theory either.
Hang on a minute. We'll move on to communism in a minute, if I may, but you said that one of the quality you're looking for is an ability to understand consequences. You mustn't assume that academics are so selfless that the ultimate consequences of society, perhaps after they're dead, are more important to them than the immediate consequences for their careers. But if I were an academic, I think I would know, indeed, or if I were in broadcasting, I think I would know pretty quickly that if I didn't fit in with the general conformist view of these matters, then I couldn't expect to get tenure or to rise in my profession. And these things are ultimately possibly more important to people than the total coherence or indeed the ultimate consequences of the points of view they espouse. Anyway, anybody can fool himself into believing that his own position is going to lead to paradise. People do that all the time.
So perhaps G.K. Chesterton was right.
About what in this case?
Chesterton and the others who have said similar things then perhaps were right. Stop believing in God and you'll believe in anything.
Well, that's also true, but some people are, in fact, many people, it seems to me, are repelled by the consequences of believing in God. They examine it, and the implications of living in a created universe with a purpose are frightening and often don't suit people's desire for pleasure. I point out in my book, The Rage Against God, a lengthy quotation from Somerset Maugham's autobiographical novel of Human Bondage, where Philip Carey describes with extraordinary frankness the moment at which he decides not to believe in God anymore, and the personal liberation which he associates with this is very strong. He's free from all kinds of obligations and fears which he previously had. If it was simply a matter of choosing one or the other, and there were no other implications, I think a lot of people would choose it. And it's not surprising to me. Actually, if people weren't brought up, as they are not now, if people aren't brought up to believe in the rather complicated concepts of the Christian religion, they're much more likely to fall into the far more convenient and more easily understood religion of selfism, as I describe it, of doing pretty much what suits you and being sovereign over your own body, which is what a lot of people now desire. Why wouldn't they?
You use the term selfism, and I think back to your time in Australia on Q&A, when a couple of times you put your views only to be sneered at. Yeah. And it struck me at that time that there's a remarkable capacity on the part of some people now to be unbelievably censorious at the same time as they want to say, don't tell us what to do. They want to tell everybody else to do. They retain that right for themselves, but they'll get an instant cheer, as one of your fellow panel members did that night, when he insists that you can't tell us what to do with our bodies.
Yes. Well, I think that's... You oughtn't to seek necessarily consistency in most people's thought, and most people are terribly inconsistent anyway, and there certainly isn't an obvious consistency in this. The causes which they adopt and the things for which they demand protection from criticism all have a specific characteristic, is that they're hostile to the particularly former Protestant Christian societies, I think. It's every cause which they espouse is one which isn't really compatible with one of those. And they then, very cunningly, it's a sort of verbal judo where they use the strength of their opponents against them. They provoke, and this has been particularly important in the issue of homosexuality, same-sex marriage and all the rest of it, they provoke conservatives into attacking this idea so that they can then portray those conservatives as bigots who wish to make other people miserable. And that's one of the reasons why conservatives have lost that fight over and over again, and why, looking back on it, I wish I hadn't taken part in it, because it was and remains a very trivial side issue. And whether, 10,000, 20,000 homosexuals can or cannot get married really isn't particularly important, given the almost total collapse of tens of millions of heterosexual marriages encouraged by state policy, which has been the real issue, the really important moral issue of Western societies over the past 50 years.
Can we go back to your time in Russia and you wrote Rage Against God? What was it, if you could sort of encapsulate it, about seeing enforced state atheism that impacted on that society and on your own thinking?
By the time I went to live in Moscow in the summer of 1990, the Soviet system was dead, a knight dead in its armour, slumped on its horse. These things were over as actively pursued policies, though there was still a passive survival of quite a lot of it. The thing that I'd expected to find, which I found, was a fair amount of secret police surveillance, a collapsing economy, a general greyness and drabness which followed from that, a hideous architecture, all the things which one had learnt to associate with Soviet communism. What I hadn't realised, because I'd concentrated upon these things, was how much more important in some ways was the state's attack, particularly on the married family, which had been taking place. There was, and perhaps above all, on private life and the parents' freedom to bring up their children as they wished to do, and the state taking it over. And there was a huge amount of physical evidence of this. Children had to go to nursery. Their parents could not afford to stay at home and look after them, but the economy was so arranged that you needed two incomes to live. Therefore, it was a kind of blackmail. And also there was this continued vestigial by then, but there was a very interesting piece of evidence of it, a continued worship of a semi-mythical figure in Soviet mythology called Pavlik Morozov. And Pavlik Morozov, there's been quite a lot of scholarship on this since the collapse of the Soviet Union, was alleged by the authorities to have been murdered, I think, by his grandfather after he had denounced his parents to the authorities. And so he was made a sort of saint by the young pioneers. And there was in Moscow, in a park, a statue of this horrible child to which the young pioneers were led in procession. And they would sing songs about how wonderful he was. They were taught to revere somebody who'd betrayed his parents to the state. And that seemed to me, the more I thought about it, to be, you could look at parts of the Soviet Union and think, well, okay, if parts of the West became very unlucky in various economic or political ways, they might look like this. But the thing which really differentiated Soviet society from the West was the worship of Pavlik Morozov. And that remains with me as the thing which I learnt while I was there, which I hadn't expected to learn, and which I now know profoundly in a way which most people don't. That statue's vanished now, by the way. I don't know where it is. I went to try and find it soon after the collapse of communism in 1991. It's gone. Most of the removed sculptures ended up in a sort of sculpture park where people could look at them, but Morozov, I don't know where he is.
So you wrote Rage Against God. The subtitle is How Atheism...
Yeah, I don't like the subtitle. I was sort of cajoled into the subtitle. Publishers love subtitles, and they cause far more trouble than titles do, and they go on and on. I'm not really sure the subtitle is true.
But it caused a major rethink. You were, you know, a young man, you were a Bolshevik.
Not when I was in Moscow, I wasn't a Bolshevik. No, I'd given that up long before. I was already a moral and social conservative before I went to live in the Soviet Union, and indeed before I ever went travelling in the Soviet Empire, which I began doing in the late 1970s. I'd given up Bolshevism, but I hadn't returned to Christianity till about the middle 80s. But no, it was a detailed understanding of something in practice, of something that I thought I'd understood in theory, but had inadequately understood in theory. And another characteristic of the worship of Pavlik Morozov was of course the contempt for the Christian religion. And I found this in the Russian friends that I made, often highly educated by the standards of Russia or of any country, very civilized people, often people who knew more English literature than I did, and certainly a lot more Russian literature, cultured, well-educated, and attempting to be Europeans in the great tradition of European culture, but imbued from their earliest years with a scorn for the Christian religion, which they could still express. These people I liked, but it was there. It had been inculcated in them. And the Soviet Union was much more successful, it seems to me, than most people think, in stamping out Christianity. You know, the revival of Orthodox Christianity since the collapse of the Soviet Union is, of course, a joy, but it really isn't by any means universal.
Does it tell a story that they failed to stamp it out, though?
Well, that's the question of how you would measure failure. I suspect that an empty secularism is still very much in the minds of most Russians to this day, and may well be for generations to come. I don't think you can re-establish Christian Russia as it was before 1917.
So you paint the picture in the book of, you pose the question, do we have to learn it all again towards the end, you know, having scrubbed God out of the public square, mocked him, ridiculed him, removed any influence, we then saw them move on the major institution, if you like, for the well-being of the community, the family.
Yeah.
That's what you saw.
Yeah.
So why would we want to risk that?
Well, we don't believe that that's what we don't believe that's what we're doing, do we? We think we're moving into an era of joy and liberation where people will not be confined by and repressed and restricted by foolish and outdated rules of behaviour. And this suits us all because in many cases these rules of behaviour are ones which get in the way of personal self-indulgence and immediate pleasure. So we don't think that. And we say, well, we've had divorce and we've had single parent families and we've had increasing state intervention in the lives of children now for half a century. Civilization hasn't collapsed. What's your complaint?
Well, I go back to where I started. People
do you want us, and they say, do you really believe that the 1950s were a golden age? To which my answer is no, and I've never said so. Do you want us to go back to those days of grey misery? No, I don't. I don't want us to go. You couldn't go back anywhere if you wanted to. But that they will portray any suggestion that these social policies have been a mistake in that way, as a silly, childish nostalgia mixed with a desire to reimpose a dreary, repressive life on everybody in your side. That's how they portray it to themselves. That's how they think of people like me.
Well, to some extent, I'm almost looking for some hope or a bright light in this.
Well, don't come here for it. If you want hope, you've come to the wrong shop. I don't do temporal hope. I think the Christian civilization of the Anglosphere, particularly in my own country, is finished. I don't see any particular reason to believe it's any more likely to survive anywhere else either. But certainly in my own country, the one which I can claim to know better than others, it is done for.
I think the issue
no reason to hope at all.
The thing that I'm driving at a little bit here, or seeking to unearth a bit, is that you do meet a lot of people who are very concerned. You do meet
you
a
do,
lot,
and I do. But you meet them because you're like that, and because you're looking for them, because they're looking for you. If you just set out into the world in general, you wouldn't find them there. They're not there.
Despite the fact that the figures show this enormous level of distrust, of disengagement,
distrust maybe, but it doesn't lead people to say, "Well, let's in that case revive the principles of the Christian religion."
I suppose
it impels them to vote for Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen.
Doesn't cause them to ask questions again, though. Doesn't cause them to reflect. Perhaps we are.
I don't think
in the wrong direction.
If they do ask questions, they don't ask them of me. And if I answered them, they wouldn't like the answers. And what I do know from experience is when I attempt to answer these questions in people's minds, they reject the answers. That's why I've given up, because it seems to me quite clear, absolutely essential for the reconstruction of civilization in the Anglosphere countries, that in all cases, actually, the ostensibly conservative political parties in them should be destroyed and replaced with genuinely conservative parties. No other arrangement could create any conceivable political hope. And when I put this forward for several years before the 2010 general election, when if the Conservative Party had lost properly, it would have been destroyed and we could have replaced it. The response I got was tribal. People preferred to stick to their tribal arrangements and to continue to vote for a party which despised them than to take any kind of radical action. What I was told in 2010 over and over again is, we've got to get Gordon Brown out. And I said, well, what does it matter whether Gordon Brown is in or out? David Cameron will be no different, realistically, in any major policy from Gordon Brown. Indeed, Gordon Brown might be a better bet. Gordon Brown is probably more hostile to European integration than David Cameron, if you're worried about that sort of thing. So it's just tribal thing. What would it matter to have five more years of a Labour government when, if you had a Conservative government, the actions of the government would be identical? Whereas If you got rid of the Conservative Party, we could build something which was genuinely conservative. As I said, you can't, in Britain today, you can't sack the government. However you vote, you'll get the same government, but you can sack the opposition. And the response to this was either incomprehension or hostility or just blankness. What is for certain is it didn't make any difference. That's the point when I gave up politics. I said there's no room for reason in universal suffrage mass politics. Tribalism always trumps reason. Look at the people who get elected and just look at what happens. Look at what they swallow.
It's interesting, really, I suspect many of today's secularists would say they are more rational than people who believed in a Christian God in the past. I suspect, actually, the truth is we're becoming less rational.
Well, I don't know. The problem with Christian belief, or indeed theist belief versus atheism, which is the fundamental question, is that reason cannot actually decide it for you. You make a moral choice. Which sort of universe do you wish to live in? Do you want to live in a cosmic car crash in which none of your actions have any significance beyond their immediate effect? Or do you want to live in a designed universe which has a discoverable purpose in which your actions have consequences well beyond their immediate effects? And you choose which you prefer. But you can't reasonably say one is right and the other is wrong, because there is no way of proving it. It's a moral choice. So to advance reason as your ally on either side seems to me to be dishonest. You have to say, no, it's a moral choice. But what's interesting to me, and what's never discussed, because the atheists will never discuss it, is why someone wants to live in a purposeless, accidental universe without any purpose or justice in it. Why would they want that? The answer seems to me to be blazingly obvious as to why they want it, but they will never discuss it or admit to it.
Wow. If then one accepts the sort of verdict that the West is in decline, it's not the first time civilizations have risen, they've declined,
that's
they've
true.
Been replaced.
The decline is seldom enjoyable.
Well, that's certainly
particularly
true
for the civilized. Mm. And the barbarians have quite a good time, but the civilized, I don't think, it's not much fun.
So
sack of Rome. You don't want to be a victim of that kind of thing.
I take the point, but there is a surprising level of despair, I think. I do think that in the community, certainly in our country, about where things are heading. There is a sort of an awareness that perhaps we're headed into very dangerous waters. And it still surprises me, even if it doesn't surprise you, that there's not more pushback, more demand that consequences be spelled out, policy options be properly explored, that real issues are grappled with and solutions found.
There's a wonderful passage in 1984, my favourite actually, where Winston Smith goes into a pro-old pub and tries to engage an old man in conversation about the past. And he's trying to find out what life was like before the revolution. Of course, the old man is useless because he remembers nothing of any political significance at all and drones on. You may remember it about top hats and boat race night and stuff. And eventually Winston Smith gives up. And he thinks maybe we're like the ant, which can only see small things but not big things. Most people simply cannot see the size of the crisis which faces us, or in any way measure themselves in such a way that they think that they could influence it. So they just turn away from it.
Then where do you see the West in 10 to 15 years' time?
I can predict with great confidence decline and possibly collapse in general, but the exact timetable of it is beyond me. I don't know. It could survive for 50 years. It could be over in three. I have no idea how quickly these things will happen, because they're subject to events which come often out of nowhere and suddenly destabilize, or non-events, things ceasing to happen which you might expect to happen for some years, and so postponing things. I don't know. 10 or 15 years could be the same as it is now. We could be living in caves. I just don't know.
Where do you see other societies going? The rise of China?
Well, I think that that China is, alas, the future. Though, of course, outside China will be different. Have you been to Istanbul?
Yes, I have.
It goes on and on and on and on. Concrete, plastic, concrete, plastic, traffic fumes, concrete, plastic, traffic fumes. Everybody working very hard for not very much reward, buying the consumer goods which they're supposed to buy, undertaking the leisure pursuits they're supposed to undertake on the computer, living this life of in which they are neither poor nor rich, not particularly free, and without any real cultural, artistic, or any other release. I see that as the future, the whole world turning into the suburbs of Istanbul. And the nature of the society which is being created, which has grown up most spectacularly in China and most spectacularly of all in Shanghai, which when I went there for the first time in its modern incarnation, terrified the wits out of me. It's like Babylon. Is this what I call the bastard child of Margaret Thatcher and Deng Xiaoping, where the loins and the wallet free and the mind is imprisoned. People can be consumers, they can work, they can play computer games and go to the movies and watch Netflix, but they can't think, they're not allowed to think, and they can't speak freely. And that's the way it's all turning. And the hegemony of China, which is coming, is going to be horrible for the world, but I can't see anything to stop it.
Well, you'd certainly have to wonder whether the vigour was there to face the problem in the West anymore.
There's certainly plenty of vigour in China.
Yes, that's the point.
And it's you, do we you have can feel the muscles of the place that? Rippling as you, I remember going up to think one of the things that always made me laugh in this era when we're all supposed to be so worried about global warming is if you go up towards Outer Mongolia on the train, you spend the entire time looking out of the train window at trains full of coal 2 miles long roaring past to fuel new coal-fired power stations. This was good. This huge force of fiery energy building this new economy and civilization. It's just not very nice.
So, Peter, hope. We all need hope.
Well, there's hope in eternity. That's where you have to look for it.
It's a message.
Temporal hope seems to me to be in short supply at the moment, and I would not try to purvey it.
So your message is very much one that we need individually to
If hope is what you want, don't look for it in politics. Politics is a false religion, almost a heresy anyway, it seems to me. And you won't find much hope in it, as I see it. I don't think there's any reason to believe that out of politics anything good will come. We're much more likely to see more Trumps than we are to see any kind of saviours of the moral universe.
Well, I don't know that any of us can operate without hope. So I guess that amounts to a plea for people to think carefully about where they stand before their maker at a personal level.
Yeah, I should say so.
Do you think, as a matter of interest, that if sufficient people did return to their roots, we could find our way out of our cultural malaise?
I suppose it's possible. I can only say what I believe and have observed, that this seems to me to be unlikely. Even as I say it, I have to confess, yes, I might be wrong, and I also have to consider that possibly by saying it, I might make it less likely, but the fact is it is what I believe to be true. I think we've had it.
I thought it was a remarkable ending to the Q&A session on Dangerous Ideas, as it was called, that your dangerous idea was that people would begin to believe again in the resurrection.
Well, yes.
And the crowd stunned. The Q&A host said, what do you mean? And
well, I know, you would have thought it was obvious that it was quite a radical thing to say. Well, particularly in the Sydney Opera House that night, it was a dangerous idea. It definitely had that quality about it.
But it had an extraordinary effect.
What, you believe that? Well.
But then he asked.
Take him away.
They're stunned. For the first time, they're silent.
Yeah.
And then you say,
well, they've never heard it in that form before. They'd always seen Christianity as a dead religion, confined in ill-attended churches run by people they imagined to be paedophiles. They had never, ever, encountered the Christian religion portrayed as the revolutionary event that it is.
But you then went on to finish in the stunned silence when the host asked you what you meant by that, that Christians would then vigorously pursue justice and mercy.
Well, you have to. If they exist, then you must find and identify and pursue them, and the universe changes. But then that is the Christian belief, isn't it? That the universe altered when Christ was born, and altered even more when Christ rose from the dead. That it was a transformation. That it was the greatest event in history, philosophy, literature, anything you care to name. It just revolutionized all of us. Because if you don't believe any of that, then it doesn't. But the reason why it's revolutionary is because its implications are so transformative. Here we have it. God lived among us as a man and said these things. Therefore, we are bound to behave in certain ways that we cannot thereafter ever avoid.
So,
it must be the greatest revolution in human thought, which is why it had such and continues to have such a huge effect on the whole world.
So, whilst the West rages against God, mocked him out of the public square, silenced him, if you like, sought to destroy the institutions that arose out of Christianity for our good, the reality is that, bad news for militant secularists, they're a dying breed. Globally, you've got an age of enormous ferment over beliefs and over religion, for want of a better word, what people will respond to and what they won't. It was once a European religion, so to speak. It's now become a religion of the East and the South, and is in many parts of the world is exploding. There have never been more Christians walking the surface of the earth than there are today.
No, but there has sometimes been, I think, more Christianity.
Right.
And numbers of Christians aren't necessarily the measure of how much Christianity there is.
So perhaps we conclude on the point that at a personal level, there can be real hope and it's worth pursuing. And as Jordan Peterson puts it, only when you sort yourself out can you really make a contribution to your fellow men anyway.
Yeah, but you know about the Shakers, an interesting American sect.
Right.
Who were admirable in many ways, though they wouldn't reproduce, so they could only expand by recruiting. And they became immensely successful in particularly the furniture that they made was so beautiful that they could command huge commercial prices for it. And they had a great, quite profound effect on American society. But as the society became more civilized under the influence of them and others that in which they were, they vanished. There are none left. And the problem with Christianity is that it creates the possibility of trust and the rule of law. And therefore it creates the possibility of societies of immense wealth and comfort in which people believe they no longer need it.
Heaven on earth.
Well, perhaps not heaven on earth, but it's certainly a society in which the amount of pleasure immediately available to us all, and the postponement of death and discomfort, and the pushing back of disease, and the very high level of peace and security in a society governed by trust is such that people forget the principles which led them to this point in the first place.
So, plenty to think about. Thank you very much.
Afraid so.
You've been listening to Conversations with John Anderson. For further content, visit johnanderson.net.au.